Before we start our episode today, this is just a reminder. History Hack does have a Patreon account and all of your donations are gratefully appreciated. There's lots of perks on there, secret groups on Facebook. Do get involved. We would love to see more of you. Enjoy the episode today.
Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. I'm very excited today. I've got Jim Crossley with me. Hello, Jim.
Hi.
We're really looking forward to this, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. We are.
This is going to be brilliant. So, Jim Crossley is a naval historian, passionate about the war at sea. He's had six relatives at Jutland, including William Goodenough, who commanded the 2nd Light Cruise Squadron. He's written six previous books on naval history, but I'm really excited about his latest one, which I finished yesterday. So he's chosen to focus on one man. I think it's fair to say that this is one man. If you are interested in either of the wars, you know the name, but you're probably like me and you don't actually know what he did or where he did it exactly. I have a feeling he was around Gallipoli at some point. Jim, we're going to talk about Roger Keyes today, aren't we?
Yes, Roger Keyes, Admiral of the fleet, Sir Roger Keyes, actually.
Yes, we should get all of the titles in at the beginning. Tell us why you decided to write a book about him.
Well, he's a sort of archetypal naval officer of the Edwardian period. He very clearly demonstrates both the weaknesses and the strengths of the Royal Navy at that time. He's also, his close relationship with Churchill actually sheds a great deal of light on the character of that great man. And I think probably puts it in a light that many people don't know.
We'll get to Grandad, won't we? Because
you've called
the book Churchill's Admiral, because he spanned two wars serving under Churchill. Can you tell us a bit about his background? Was he always destined for the Royal Navy?
No, he wasn't. His father was a general in the Indian Army, and his infancy was in India, and then like lots of other people, including Kipling, he was sent to England to a vicar's family to because the Indian climate was not healthy for young people, and there he was somewhat abused, he was. His father wanted him to go into the army, but he was very strong character and he was very persistent, and he defied the general and managed to get sent to the Navy instead.
Good job for the Royal Navy.
Mm-hmm.
His early career took him to China, didn't it? In what capacity?
Well, he went to China as a commander of a destroyer, which was destroyers at that time were really quite small ships with a crew of about 35 people. He went as commander of a destroyer, but because he was so keen in getting involved with the fighting, he left the destroyer for a lot of the time in charge of the second in command, and went ashore and went with the army to Beijing and fought on foot very, very bravely against the Chinese. This was the Boxer Rebellion.
Mm-hmm. It's very hornblower, isn't it?
It's very hornblower. Couldn't be more hornblower. Yeah,
this is what I love about the Royal Navy of this time, is the opportunity to just show initiative.
Oh, yes, and they fought on land very much more than they fought at sea. I mean, nobody dared to fight them at sea, but on land, of course, they fought a lot in sort of minor colonial wars and indeed in the Boer War.
Is he particularly promising at this point?
He is a bit of a maverick. He's a very fine destroyer captain, and he manages to do with his destroyer things that have never been done with small ships before. So he was very good at that, but he was a bit undisciplined. When he went ashore in China, he was actually defying the admiral who was in charge of the whole fleet. He got a severe, he nearly got relieved of his command, but he had such personal charm and such a reputation for gallantry that he was forgiven and went on to higher things.
So let's bring Churchill into the story. So Churchill becomes First Lord of the Admiralty in 1911, doesn't he?
Yeah,
when
that's
did
correct.
He first notice Keyes, and how does their relationship start?
Well, he noticed Keyes almost immediately, because Keyes had been came to an end of his career in submarines, and he was made in destroyers, and he was made the officer responsible for developing the submarine force. Britain already had quite a number of submarines, although a lot of them were very primitive boats. Keyes was given the job of developing them and developing their sort of fighting tactics. And Churchill was always on to anything new, and he loved the idea of the submarines. Almost his first week in, that's Churchill's first week in office.
Yep.
He came down and went underwater in a submarine with Keyes in command, and got very excited about it. And that was really how the relationship began.
I think that's Churchill does the same with tanks, doesn't he? You're right. Anything new.
Absolutely right. Yes. Tanks, armoured cars, anything like that. And aircraft actually as well.
Which I like to think, like, this is what I'd be like. I'd be like, oh, new shiny machine. And I'd be completely sidetracked as well.
That's why you've got the name Churchill. You see, there you are.
There you go, yeah. But I love that boyish aspect of his nature, to get excited about anything new that comes up and to get behind it, even if I think there must be some nonsense ideas in there as well that didn't make a difference in warfare, which it would be interesting to look at. So let's talk about the First World War. Keyes is at Gallipoli, isn't he?
Yes, he was sent to Gallipoli, but he didn't get on well with Fisher, who, of course, came in as First Sea Lord at the beginning of the war. And Fisher relieved him of command of the submarines and sent him to Gallipoli, and where he was Chief of Staff to Admiral de Roebuck, who was in charge of the naval operations there most of the time. Keyes was an extremely active, he got the reputation as he got the name of that mad sailor. He was always going ashore and fighting with the troops, and he was strangely embarrassed by the fact that whereas the army were taking lots and lots of casualties, the navy were taking practically none. And he actually sought more casualties. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing, but he did, because he thought that the Navy was losing face and could be accused of cowardice in its attitude to the Dardanelles operation.
That's a wider feeling in the Navy, isn't it, during this period of frustration, definitely before Jutland, at not playing their part and wanting to get involved and watching everything happen on land.
That's absolutely right. And this huge force, which was so superior to any other, was just sitting there doing nothing. And the Germans, of course, had exactly the same thing. The German fleet was held in great contempt, except for the U-boats, because it sat there doing nothing while the soldiers were all getting killed on in the trenches.
It makes perfect sense in a way, doesn't it? I mean, if you had spent a fortune on a shiny new Ferrari, you wouldn't send it into battle. And that's essentially what these huge ships were. They were expensive, they were coveted, they were precious. And I think definitely in the German case, I think maybe the British Navy was just a bit too superior, wasn't it? And like,
yeah, it was, yes.
And to fight them, so... Mm. Yeah, which is what all the U-boats are about, because it's a way of getting around that superiority, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely, and very nearly succeeded in doing so.
He does serve with the Grand Fleet as well, doesn't he?
Yes, very uneventful. He was captain of a battleship, and then he was in charge of a division of three battleships. He was, but didn't see any action at all. There was one occasion when the fleet went out because they thought the Germans were coming out. Actually, they weren't. And on that occasion, his ship happened to be in dry dock, and he went nearly mad because she couldn't join the fleet. But anyway, no fighting happened, so it didn't make any difference.
I'm gonna well, make people read the book to find out more about the Grand Fleet stuff, because I guess that's what everyone wants to know, is about his time.
Yes.
Serving with the big boys. But what really interests me, can you explain to our listeners, because I love this, can you explain to them what the Dover Patrol was?
Oh, well, the Dover Patrol was the most active part of the Navy throughout the war. Mm. It was based, surprisingly enough, in Dover. And it had the responsibility, the Dover Patrol had the responsibility for keeping the channel open for troop ships and supplies going to France, and not one troop ship was sunk during the war. It was responsible for stopping submarines, German U-boats, getting down channel and out into the Western approaches where they could torpedo merchant ships. And it was also an important function was to keep a bit of pressure on the right flank of the German army. So they were always having to deploy quite a lot of troops and artillery in Belgium where there was no fighting going on, but they were always afraid that the British might land, which indeed they did at the Zeebrugge raid.
Yeah.
So it was a constant threat to Germany, and that was one of the roles of the Dover Patrol.
Because, of course, we came very close to doing it in 17, didn't we, with Operation Hush as well, which was,
yes, where yes.
I think it was Rawlinson and 4th Army, but I'm not sure if it was called, yeah, 4th Army, coming in on the coast as well. So it was definitely, they could never take their eye off it, could they?
Yes, that was actually in the days of Bacon, who was Keyes's predecessor in charge of the Dover Patrol, another very interesting man. But
his book is wonderful, actually, on the Dover Patrol. If people want to know more about that madness, it's
yes, great. I strongly recommend that. It's a wonderful book.
So Keyes, you've mentioned, he succeeds Bacon, who's probably the famous one that commands the Dover Patrol. So how does he do?
He takes a very different view to Bacon of almost everything. He didn't like Bacon. He called the streaky one.
I love naval officers. It's so bitchy. I love it.
Yeah, I didn't like him. Anyway, Bacon was very negative about most new ideas for catching submarines.
Okay.
Particularly, the idea was to force them to the surface by putting down mine nets, and then illuminating them and destroying them with gunfire. Bacon didn't like doing that because he thought that it was too dangerous for the boats that were doing the destruction with gunfire. Keyes totally disagreed and did use gunfire and actually eventually succeeded in more or less completely stopping U-boats getting down the channel. He was successful in that. He was also successful in making the Zeebrugge raid onto the harbour at Zeebrugge. It was very, very expensive in casualties. It only held the harbour for a few hours, and it was really, by most standards, a disaster. On the other hand, it did shake the Germans considerably, and they really started to lose morale after the Zeebrugge raid for really complex reasons, which are difficult to understand. But they realized they had a vulnerability there, which was very positive for us, and also it gave a terrific flip to the general morale of the country that suddenly we raided the coast held by Germans, and we destroyed the lock gates, which actually we hadn't, we'd done something to stop submarines getting down the channel. So it was a huge morale flip to the nation.
It was, and as well, some absolutely astounding stories of bravery as well connected with the men who served in those raids.
Yes, quite extraordinary. And another interesting thing is that Keyes insisted that all the men involved should be either Royal Navy or Royal Marines. He wouldn't have army men on at all, just to even up this thing about casualties. I mean, it was an extraordinary obsession with him. He would have thought that he'd try to use experienced army officers to at least give some guidance, but he wouldn't have it. They all had to be sailors.
Some inter-service rivalry there. I knew I was worked with Geoffrey Drummond, the VC winner's family. Because he was an Etonian, so he's in the naval chapter of my Eton book. So yeah, some astonishing sort of it's weird, isn't it? Because they're very Royal Naval, they're very the raids are very ad hoc, they're very Hornblower like, they're very sort of initiative based as well. There was a plan, but the plan disappears very quickly, doesn't it? And you've got a lot of individual small groups of men.
Exactly. A total underestimate of the difficulty of landing under fire. Everything was reduced to a shambles, and it was only the terrific courage of these chaps, a lot of them Royal Marines, who they achieved anything at all.
So you've mentioned the morale dip to the German Navy, and of course the German Navy is where it's the beginning of the end for Germany itself, really, in terms of like the whole order collapsing, isn't it, with the mutinies at Kiel?
Yes, absolutely.
So it goes, how does he see the end of the war then? Is he involved in the surrender of the German fleet or when they're interned?
No, he wasn't involved in that, I think, at all. He was, at the end of the war, he spent a lot of time going around on sort of morale-raising expeditions. And being made freemen of various cities and that sort of thing, he was treated as quite a hero. Also, he was running. There was a lot of toing and froing of politicians and senior officers between France and Germany, and he was more or less running a ferry service of destroyers doing that. During which they had some. Quite exciting incidents, and then he was also responsible initially for sweeping up the tens of thousands of mines which both sides had laid in the in the Western approaches, and in the and in the Channel. There was a lot of mine sweeping to be done.
Indeed. What does he do during the interwar period? So we now have sort of a break, obviously, with active service in terms of fighting the Germans. He's not very popular at all, is he?
No, he's not. He made a lot of enemies for various reasons. One, he was very opposed to the formation of the Royal Air Force, or who really took over the Royal Naval Air Service, and he was very upset about that. And he argued the case with a lot of senior people, which made him unpopular. He also became CNC Mediterranean, which was the sort of top job at sea for an admiral. And he was not a great success in that role. He was considered to be too much of a playboy, spent too much time playing polo and that kind of thing, and not enough on the ships. There was also a ridiculous incident called the Royal Oak incident, where there was a row on one of the battleships in the Mediterranean fleet under his command, somebody called the bandmaster a nasty little bugger. And the band retired, and somehow this got back to the papers in the UK, and it got blown up into a tremendous scandal. The king got involved and was absolutely furious, it really did tarnish Keyes's reputation in a big way. He also, of course, was a strong supporter of Churchill and didn't like disarmament. He didn't like the various naval treaties which reduced the superiority of the Royal Navy. He was really up against all the fashionable trends at the time, and he made himself very unpopular.
How does their relationship go in the interwar period? Because I can
with Churchill.
So they're very pragmatic in terms of when there's a war on. Obviously, they're great pals, but is it the same when?
Oh yes, he got on very well with Churchill between the wars, although Churchill disagreed with him as far as the formation of the RAF was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
They got on very well. Churchill encouraged him to go into politics, and he did. He became MP for Portsmouth, overturning a strong Labour majority. They made great friends. Churchill invited him to join his sort of private club that he ran, and obviously very much enjoyed his company, he was it was one of the wonderful things about Churchill that he was able to sort of comprehend all these different sorts of people in his friendship group, and Keyes was very much a part of that.
It's perhaps unsurprising then, in 1939, Churchill returns to the Admiralty, and he has Keyes back, doesn't he? Is this a game changer for Keyes? The beginning, obviously, he's going to serve in another war.
Yeah.
But in terms, if the war hadn't have happened, was he done pretty much? Is this a revival of his career?
Yes, I mean, by this time he was getting on. He was in his 60s. And he was too old for active service. And what he longed to do was to go do the same sort of things as he'd done in China. And really, he wanted to. And the big thing was he wanted to make a raid on the Italian island of Pantelleria, and the scheme involved him going ashore from a destroyer and sort of charging onto the island with a bayonet. Well, you don't do that when you're an admiral of the fleet and nearly 70 years old.
Yeah, we love this about you chaps, though, Jim. You're always 12 years old, even when you do get to admiral of the fleet and you're in your 70s. There's still that little boy in there.
I'd be a bit more cautious than Keyes was, I must say.
And he does, and yet there's a theme still, isn't there, with his being involved in new things. Because tell us about his part in the history of the commandos.
Yes. Well, now the commandos was Churchill's idea. He thought that you could form a little group of highly trained and very aggressive soldiers and marines, and you could land them in France or on the German coast or something like that as sort of pinpricks. It didn't work very well. There were the only two successful operations of that. One was the Brunivelle raid, where Marines went ashore and and soldiers and captured a German radar station and brought all the equipment back. And the other one was, of course, the great Saint-Nazaire raid, which was a great success of blowing up the dockyards in Saint-Nazaire. That was done by people trained by Keyes, but they were both happened after he had been removed by Churchill from command of the commandos. He trained the commando forces, but he didn't. He never actually led them or directed them in battle, which was a great disappointment for him.
Yeah, probably sensible. he is of an older persuasion at this point. But one thing that he remains good for during the Second World War is PR, isn't it?
Yes. He was very good at PR, and he used to go around factories, and there were a lot of strikes, you know, in the factories and coal mines. And he used to be sent to the place where the trouble was to give rousing speeches. And he was very effective at that. Although he wasn't a great public speaker, he had a sincerity, and he used to meet union leaders and that kind of thing, and talk them into being a bit more loyal to their country. Mm. And he was able to do that. It's surprising, but he was. And he was very useful, used a great deal in that role. And then, of course, he was quite a hero with the Americans for various reasons.
Yeah.
He'd when he was with the Dover Patrol, he took a lot of American admirals to see him in destroyers and things, which they found very exciting. And so he had a great reputation in America, and he was able to meet with President Roosevelt, and he was able to do a good PR job from that point of view. And then, of course, he went with the Pacific Fleet to the great battle of Leyte Gulf, where unfortunately he breathed in a lot of phosphorus smoke, which ruined his lungs. But it was all part of a sort of PR thing, and he turned out to be very good, very useful at that.
Yeah, absolutely. And they that was something that obviously that role was down to Kitchener in the first part of the First World War, going around and giving those sort of speeches. So you had to be of a certain standing, didn't you, to
walk exactly
people,
yes,
who didn't want to work, and explain to them, look, if you don't, then the war effort's buggered, basically.
Yeah, exactly right. Yes, that's just what he did. And he did the same thing actually in Australia. The Australian shipwrights wouldn't work at weekends and one thing or another on repairing ships. And he gave them a terrific bollocking, and appealed to their better nature. I think it was quite effective.
Yeah, I think he definitely is a character as well. Let's just finally, how important is he to Churchill in the first half of the 20th century?
I think he was very important to Churchill because he was a personal friend. Not really, never going to be a politician. He just didn't have that sort of brain. He was a personal friend. He was not a threat to Churchill, although he opposed his ideas sometimes. And I think Churchill regarded him as a kind of beacon of a sort of behaviour and a sort of pure character, which he didn't encounter in the political sphere. I mean, all politicians, part of the job, are devious and cunning. And Keyes was the reverse of that. He was not devious. He was not cunning. He was just a straightforward, good egg. And I think Churchill, with his wonderful ability to attract people and communicate with all types of people, felt that he was a very good balance against the politicians that he normally was dealing with.
I think, yeah, sometimes you just need a break, don't you, from all the machinations and the scheming and the sort
of
nature of politics.
Yeah, I mean, the Churchill had to give him the most terrific bollockings from time to time, because he was being so rude about the Admiralty and calling them all cowards and all that. But Churchill really, Churchill was able to calm all that down and see what a fine fellow was behind it all with good motives.
Jim, thank you so much for coming on and introducing us to Admiral Roger Keyes. The book is brilliant. The book is Churchill's Admiral in Two World Wars. It's out now. We'll make sure it's available via our History Hack bookshop online as well. Do buy it. It's wonderful. And do check out some of Jim's other books as well. There's a particularly good one that was a centenary book about Jutland as well.
Thank you very much, Alex. Very nice to talk to you, and best of luck.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.